Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Yesterday, the Israeli army began a ground invasion of the Gaza Strip. An hour before it began, a Palestinian from Gaza told the Israeli newspaper Haaretz that, quote, they're firing from every direction. Everything here is shaking, end quote. International journalists in Gaza have been told to evacuate their beachfront hotels just one day after witnessing the deaths of four Palestinian boys who were hit by Israeli airstrikes while they were playing on the beach. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, over 260 Palestinians have been killed. According to the UN, nearly 80% of the casualties have been civilians. 1,800 have been injured. One Israeli has been killed by rocket fire, and one Israeli soldier has died. According to the United Nations, 1,370 homes have been destroyed in Gaza, and more than 22,000 people have been displaced. Also yesterday, the United States Senate passed a resolution reaffirming its support for Israel. The resolution passed through a unanimous consent agreement. On today's Your Call, we are speaking with journalists about coverage of the assault. In about 10 minutes, we'll be joined by Sharif Abdul-Qudus, an independent journalist and Democracy Now! Correspondent who is in Gaza. Joining us now is Mark Seibel, Chief of Correspondence and Foreign Editor with McClatchy Newspapers. Its 30 daily papers include the Sacramento Bee, the Fresno Bee, and the Modesto Bee. Hi, Mark. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
It's always nice to have you. We're also joined by Samer Badawi. He is a regular contributor to 972. That is a blog-based web magazine that provides reporting and analysis of events in Israel and Palestine. Samer is a former D.C. correspondent for Middle East International, and he joins us from D.C. Hi, Samer. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Nice to have you. Thank you. And we're joined by Larry Durfner. Larry also writes for 972 magazine and contributes to Salon, Tablet, The Forward, and other publications. Larry is a former columnist with the Jerusalem Post and correspondent in Israel for U.S. News and World Report. He moved from Los Angeles to Israel back in 1985, and he joins us from Tel Aviv. Hi, Larry. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thank you for joining us. So as we always do on Friday, we like to start off by giving a reporter kudos, a reporter who did a good job this week. So Mark, what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I don't usually tout one of our own stories, but I'm going to today. And it's a piece that Mitchell Prothero, who writes for us now out of Erbil, Iraq, did that's an overview on the Iraqi army and its status. It got a lot of internet attention. Basically, its conclusion was that, you know, we're 5 weeks, now 6 weeks, into this takeover of by the Islamic State of about half of Iraq. And there is hasn't been much really about the fighting that's going on. And what Mitch's story points out is that, to date, every offensive action by the Iraqi military has failed. And then he also goes into what equipment the Islamic State really did get hold of, including 52 long-range GPS U.S.-manufactured artillery weapons that are quite serious things to have lost control of. And it was a very, very good overview of what the current military situation is as the U.S. begins its own or has finalized its own assessment of whether the Iraqi army can be helped or not. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it got a lot of attention, deservedly so, because it was really the first effort someone had made to say, wait a minute, what's the status of the situation in Iraq?
Is he there full-time, Mitch?
Yes, he'll be at least for the next 6 months in Erbil.
Okay, well, we'll definitely have to get him on the show.
He'd be good.
Yeah, all right, thank you for that. And we're putting that story on our website right now at yourcallradio.org. What about you, Samer? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, Rose, I'm going to cite one that I think will probably come up later in the conversation and then maybe give a hot tip to another one really quickly. The first was by Ayman Mohyeddin, the NBC reporter that has since been pulled out of Gaza, as many of your listeners may know. Hmm. And it was a story that he filed on July 16th after he had witnessed the killing of four Palestinian boys on a Gaza beach that's frequented by many foreign journalists there, and a beach that I have seen many times myself. You know, Ayman does a fantastic job of really blending the sort of empathic voice of any reporter in a war zone with the facts of the case. And in this case, what NBC presumably saw as offensive and decided to pull him out of Gaza for was the fact that he noted that he himself had been playing soccer with these children moments before they were blown up. And so he does a fantastic job of humanizing these Palestinian children, who, of course, are four among, what is now 45 children who have been killed in the last 10 days. So I'd urge your listeners to check out that story. The other that I just want to mention very quickly was by Noah Browning a couple of days ago, and he's a Reuters reporter in Gaza now. And what he did was something that very few reporters and very few media outlets here in the U.S. have been doing over the last 10 days. That's that he actually asked Palestinians what they thought about the ceasefire. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of reporting about, what Hamas thinks, what the Egyptians think, what the Israelis think, what the Americans think. And in this case, Noah actually went out and talked to real Palestinians. And the sense that he got is the same one that I think a lot of us on this call have been getting online through social media. And that is that many Palestinians view, a purported ceasefire as really a continuation of what Noah called a living death under blockade. It's important to remember that Gazans have been, under siege for the better part of a decade now. And any end of the shooting really end their humanitarian predicament. So that's two articles for you.
Well, thank you. And later in the show, I'd like to ask all of you about Ayman Mohideen, the NBC news correspondent who personally witnessed the killing of the four boys on a beach. We don't know exactly. I mean, I'd love to get your views on why NBC told him to leave immediately. They cited security reasons, but he was replaced by another correspondent, Richard Engel. So we'll definitely talk about that later in the show. And thank you for those, Samer. What about you, Larry? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
It's an op-ed by, it's in the New York Times. One of the things I like about it is that it was printed in the New York Times. It's written by Nathan Thrall, and it was published yesterday in the op-ed section of the New York Times, and it's called How the West Chose War in Gaza. Okay? And he talks about how especially that Hamas came to this whole situation in really terrible shape, and the people in Gaza were in really terrible shape, and then Hamas, made that deal with Fatah for the Palestinian Unity Government, which was an opportunity for the people in Gaza to get a better break, also to moderate Hamas, to bring, let's say, Palestinian politics under the rule of a moderate leadership coming out of the West Bank. But Israel blocked it, and the United States blocked it. And then we come to the situation today, and the other thing about the article that I like a lot is that it talks about, it was mentioned before, it talks about how the people in Gaza feel, and it talks about why the ceasefire that was offered them is so totally unacceptable. If I can quote maybe a paragraph here.
Yes.
Says, Hamas is now seeking through violence what it couldn't obtain through a peaceful handover of responsibilities. Israel is pursuing a return to the status quo ante, when Gaza had electricity for barely 8 hours a day, water was undrinkable, sewage was dumped in the sea, fuel shortages caused sanitation plants to shut down, and waste sometimes floated in the streets. Patients needing medical care couldn't reach Egyptian hospitals, and Gazans paid $3,000 bribes for a chance to exit when Egypt chose to open the border crossing. For many Gazans, and not just Hamas supporters, it's worth risking more bombardment and now the ground incursion for a chance to change that unacceptable status quo. A ceasefire that fails to resolve the salary crisis and open the salary crisis is this is a very important point that's coming out recently that was totally neglected before, and that is that 43,000 Hamas employees in the Gaza Strip have not been paid because Israel stopped the payment. Okay, and like this Nathan Thrall says, you cannot expect. You cannot run Gaza. You can't expect a government of 43,000 employees to keep order when they're not getting paid. So finally, it says a ceasefire that fails to resolve the salary crisis and open Gaza's border with Egypt will not last. You know?
And this is an op-ed written by Nathan Thrall. I actually just printed it out this morning because it's getting a lot of attention on Facebook. Nathan Thrall is a senior analyst at the International Crisis Group covering Gaza, Israel, Jordan, and the West Bank. And Larry, this provides a lot of context that is missing from a lot of the reporting. And I actually wanted to ask you about that because you wrote a piece for 972 called How Netanyahu Provoked This War. I mean, the main theme that we're seeing in so much reporting is that this all started when the three Israeli young boys living in a settlement were kidnapped and killed. So can you talk about that? And how, where else are you seeing context like this?
Well, I think first of all, the fact that this was printed in the New York Times is great. I think a similar story, similar to the one that I wrote, was printed in The Forward, which is an American Jewish newspaper, a very good one. And it was written by their number one writer named J.J. Goldberg, and he wrote the piece blaming Israel for provoking this war, and that's also kind of remarkable to see that in The Forward. I think it's remarkable to see this piece today by Nathan Thrall in the New York Times. You can trace it to the occupation itself of 1967. Some people would trace it to before that. I think I trace it to the peace talks between Israel and the Palestinian Authority that were run by John Kerry. They failed, and Israel was almost unanimously blamed for that failure, even by United States officials. And I think Netanyahu was doing real bad politically, being blamed for that. And he used the opportunity of the unity agreement between Abu Mazen's Fatah in the West Bank and Hamas to try to shift the blame from himself over to the Palestinians by saying, you see who we're negotiating with a guy who makes a unity government with a terrorist group. Okay? The problem was nobody was buying that argument. The United States recognized that government. The Europeans recognized the government. And then on June 12th, the three boys were kidnapped, and Netanyahu blamed it on Hamas. And it's even understood now in Israel. Every reporter in Israel with any sense is saying that evidently the leadership of Hamas didn't know about that kidnapping, didn't order it, didn't know where those three boys were, and yet Israel blamed Hamas and went after Hamas and arrested tons of Hamasniks in the West Bank, you know, to take revenge and also to put the blame for the situation on the Palestinians, both Hamas and Abu Mazen and the Fatah, to try to shift the blame for the failure of the peace talks from himself to the Palestinian leadership. And one thing led to another. You know, after the boys were kidnapped, Israel, they arrested numerous Hamasniks. They killed about six Palestinian protesters in the West Bank. They confiscated just about it. You know, what it was said by one Israeli security official that the target in the West Bank at that time was anything green, anything, you know, a Hamas flag they were confiscating and raiding homes. And after that, things heated up between, not so much between Hamas and Israel, but between other armed groups in Gaza, like the Islamic Jihad and other groups. They increased their rocketing at Israel, and Israel increased its rocketing at them. And, you know, I don't want to go into all the details, but basically things heated up until finally, you know, Israel, actually there were a few days after all this that Israel did try to restrain its rocketing. But then one day they hit a tunnel in Gaza, and I think nine Hamasniks were killed. After that, Hamas began to fire rockets. And one thing that's extremely important to understand that nobody seems to remember is that until a couple of weeks ago, Hamas did not fire a single rocket at Israel for a year and a half. Okay?
That is Larry.
And so we got from there a year and a half of no rockets from Hamas to where we are now.
And that is Larry Dorfner. His piece, How Netanyahu Provoked This War, is at yourcallradio.org. He writes for 972, which is a web-based magazine that provides reporting and analysis of events in Israel and Palestine. 972 is the telephone area code that is shared by Israel and Palestine. And Larry is a former columnist for the Jerusalem Post. He was also a correspondent in Israel for U.S. News and World Report. He moved from Los Angeles to Israel in 1985. He's joining us from Tel Aviv. We're also joined by Samer Badawi. He's a regular contributor to 972 and a former D.C. correspondent for Middle East International. Mark Seibel is chief of correspondents and foreign editor with McClatchy Newspapers, which include the SAC Bee and the Fresno Bee. And we're talking today about media coverage of what's happening in Gaza. You can give us a call, Israel and Palestine. You can give us a call. Where are you seeing good coverage, and where are you seeing the context beyond what happened to the three boys who were kidnapped and killed? Because a lot of the media are saying that this started with that. So where are you seeing context and some history? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. What really strikes you about media coverage of Israel and Palestine? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Mark, how can reporters provide this kind of context when things are moving so quickly and so many people are dying?
Well, I think that's actually the biggest challenge, because for most American newspapers, and leave the New York Times and the Washington Post and the LA Times out of that equation, but most people don't read those newspapers. Most American newspapers are going to carry a story, and they're going to be focused on whatever it is that happened today. And when you adopt that sort of an editorial approach, then you find yourself writing or publishing just today's basic news, which is going to be ground invasion, 30 dead, that kind of stuff, ceasefire not reached, and then some fairly shorthand about how the conflict arose. But you're not really going to be able to treat in that kind of a story the kind of context issues that need to be addressed. I'm sure that for most American readers, even the Netanyahu attack on Hamas infrastructure in the West Bank after the three teenagers disappeared, I imagine most Americans weren't really aware of that. The fact that, 450 people who surely had nothing to do with the abduction and the murder had been arrested, 50 prisoners that had been released previously in an agreement with Hamas on an exchange for Gilad Shalit, the Israeli soldier who'd been held for a number of years. That members of the Palestinian legislature were picked up and put in jail. I'm sure most Americans weren't even aware of that, and that it was treated only in passing in the coverage. And the events actually took off so quickly that it was difficult to develop those as separate stories. And so as long as American newspapers are looking at one story a day, you're not going to see that kind of context. And yet, it's those sidebars pieces that actually are more illuminating about the background of the situation. I would say it's unlikely, for example, that most Americans are aware that if you live in Gaza, you can't leave. Mm. I mean, you are blockaded in, and that's gone on for years. And most people would be surprised. There is one person I was talking to said, "You mean they can't go on vacation?" And I thought, well, yeah, there's a first world problem.
Samer, what would you like to add when we're talking about context? Patty Culhane wrote a piece. She's the White House correspondent for Al Jazeera English. And she wrote, "The formula is simple as it applies to most print and broadcast journalism outlets. You always start your story with a description of the rockets. The first pictures are always of rockets fired from Gaza." She pointed out evening newscasts starting ABC News today after more than 1,000 rockets launched by Hamas, CBS News. The Israeli military insists it is targeting terrorists. She says that when Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu goes on the Sunday shows, he receives deferential treatment. So what are your thoughts about the context, and how do you think the media should report on the rockets?
Well, I mean, I think what Mark was just saying was absolutely vital. You know, there are bits of context here that are not terribly hard to explicate to American readers or viewers. And one of them clearly is the fact that you have 1.8 million people who are essentially living in the largest open-air prison in the world. And those are words that were not invented by me or anyone on this call. They were actually cited by the UN. So when you're talking, for example, about the fact that Netanyahu and his military commanders ordered 100,000 people from the northern tip of a 25-mile strip of land to leave their homes in a matter of minutes, you know, without knowing that there is literally nowhere for them to go, that story is going to come across very, very differently to American readers. So I just want to second what Mark said. And that's not, you know, we're not talking here about delving into, you know, the deep centuries-long, as people here like to call it, conflict between Palestinians and Israelis. But rather, you know, a simple sentence that explains that there has, in fact, been a siege on Gaza and that siege has been deemed illegal by the international community. The other piece of this is that, one of the sort of easiest ways to turn a story on its head is by working with the headline. And when you look at some of the headlines, I mean, you just cited a couple of examples in which, you know, when Hamas is noted, we hear Hamas fired rockets. There's literally an active verb in that headline, which describes intent and describes action to a particular agent. Now, when Palestinian children are killed on a beach in Gaza, as they were on July 16th in that story that I mentioned by Ayman, what we had in the New York Times was initially a headline that said, four young boys killed playing on Gaza beach. There's absolutely no agent in that headline. And so you look at that and then, you know, you sort of subconsciously wonder, well, why was this happening in the first place? And it's open to the reader to sort of fill in the blanks. And so often, given the other coverage that sort of surrounds that kind of a story, Americans' default position is that, well, it was their fault because either they shouldn't have been on the beach to begin with, or it was Hamas's fault and blame for firing rockets. Now, curiously, in the case of that New York Times story, the headline was actually later changed to something even more innocuous. And I'm saying this with a sort of a pinch of salt because I'm actually a fan of the writer Anne Barnard, who ordinarily does a fantastic job. And in fact, I mean, it's important to point out here that editors make the decisions on headlines, and so in this case, I don't fault her for this. But when you look at the sort of subsequent headline that was changed online, it was even more innocuous. And here's what it read. Boys drawn to Gaza beach and into center of Mideast strife. Now, we're talking about four children under the age of 12 who were literally blown apart by an Israeli bomb. And so, you know, you look at a story like that and you wonder, well, how is it that you can, I mean, first of all, not ascribing intent and action to anyone is simply bad journalism. It's bad writing. It's bad form. And second of all, you know, you're a journalist on the ground, and there's a certain amount of empathy that goes into reporting that needs to be reflected in stories like that. And I think what we're saying here is not out of the ordinary, precisely because when the three yeshiva students were kidnapped and murdered in the West Bank, this was not at all the case. So every story that we read about them was very careful to contextualize who they were, how old they were, the fact that their mothers were crying, and the fact that the entire Israeli body politic was mourning their disappearance first and then their murder.
And Samer, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. Today, it's our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news, and we are talking with journalists about coverage of what's happening in Palestine and Israel. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
If you'd like to join today's conversation, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Or you can send your question or comment via email. The email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, World Have Your Say, and then at 12 today, the Tavis Smiley Show, here on 91.7 FM, KALW San Francisco, local public radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, Holly Kernan will have a conversation with Ty Moses, author of Zooburbia, Meditations on the Wild Animals Among Us. More than 80% of Americans live in cities or suburbs, which means many of us are cut off from nature. But Moses says urban animals are all around us if we just look for them. That is on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it is our media roundtable, and we are speaking with journalists about coverage of the ground invasion in Gaza and the assault that has taken place over the last 11 days. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, over 260 Palestinians have been killed. According to the UN, nearly 80% of the casualties have been civilians. 1,800 have been injured. One Israeli has been killed by rocket fire. An Israeli soldier has died today. According to the UN, 1,370 homes have been destroyed in Gaza. More than 22,000 people have been displaced. We're joined today by Mark Seibel, Chief of Correspondents and Foreign Editor with McClatchy Papers. The 30 daily papers include the Sac Bee and the Fresno Bee. Samer Badawi is a regular contributor to 972. It's a web-based magazine that provides reporting on Israel and Palestine. Samer is former D.C. correspondent for Middle East International. Larry Dürfner writes for 972. He's a former columnist for the Jerusalem Post and correspondent in Israel for U.S. News and World Report. And we've got full lines. You can give us a call in a couple minutes at your 866-798-8255 or give us drop an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Staz in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to the show. Hello, Staz. Did we lose him? Let's go to our next caller.
Do you not hear me?
Oh, hi. Yes, you're there. Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I find the tone of your media roundtable somewhat ironic. I mean, I think that the it's purportedly neutral, but the your guests have been chosen specifically for the bias that you've noted in their writing, and I think that falls in line with your own particular views, Ms. Aguilar, which you regularly take a stance against Israel, and it's sort of a knee-jerk reaction, and nobody's mentioning that they also have a point of view. They also feel that some violence has been inflicted upon them, so a more biased discussion would be welcome, maybe with some additional journalists who on equal footing with those of your guests who can express alternate viewpoints.
Well, Staz, can you stay on the line? What do you think is missing from the conversation? And Larry Dürfner is in Tel Aviv, so let's ask him directly the questions you have. He's been reporting on these issues for decades.
Well, it seems to me that and I'm here in San Francisco. I'm not. I don't have any clearer view of what's going on the ground than anybody else here in the States. But Hamas was given every opportunity to seize its rocket fire, and that was. I think that's a reasonable insistence on the part of Israel, and I'd like to hear why that's not being discussed.
All right, Larry, would you address that question?
I think they were offered a rotten deal. I think the deal they were offered was the one offered by Egypt, and you know that Israel was in favor of it. That was a return to the way things were in Gaza before. And the article that I read from the New York Times explains why that was. You know, you're asking them to live in hell. You know, you're asking them to accept that, and it's not fair, and it's not right. And that's why it should have never been expected that they should accept it. You know, the people in Gaza, they have a right to be free. They have a right to live decent lives. They have never lived that, certainly not for the last several decades. And that's the main reason Hamas turned down the and that's why the Palestinians in Gaza seem to have been opposed to accepting that. So I don't think it was a decent offer. It wasn't a fair offer. I mean, Israel would not no country on earth would accept terms like that. Why expect them to?
But no country can accept, you know, rocket fire haphazardly strewn about its populace. Maybe it was a rotten deal, but if you can accept a ceasefire at least for a few hours, then you have a chance to explain your diplomatic position.
But everybody knows they're diplomats.
And offer alternatives that are more reasonable to your position. If you really want to protect your population, you can't really do that through rocket fire. Israel is of course going to overreact. It's a modern state. They're not going to allow some, you know, little organization that controls only a small corner of the country to randomly attack civilian targets. I just don't think that this is any big surprise that Israelis would overreact.
You know, let me jump in here for just a second.
Mark Seibel.
Yeah, because I think, you know, there needs to be a recognition that there are in fact two positions here, and that there are some issues that do not get talked about beyond the rocket fire, and some of those, you know, we thought we had resolved in previous iterations of ceasefires. Supposedly, after the 2012 ceasefire, the boundaries were to be opened, or the borders were to be opened. There was to be better access to agricultural land, better access to fishing rights, those kinds of things, so that people in Gaza could live a more normal life. And really that didn't happen. The change of leadership in Egypt has made life difficult for Gaza again because El-Sisi, the new president, is absolutely opposed to Hamas, opposed to the Muslim Brotherhood, which is sort of Hamas's big brother, mentor. And so things have gotten very bad for Hamas. On the other side, you do have to acknowledge Hamas is not very accepting of the existence of the State of Israel, and I've heard people in Hamas discuss that. However, an awful lot of people felt that the formation of a unity government was actually a step in the right direction in terms of moving Hamas beyond their rejectionist status. And Netanyahu really finished that off with the assault on Hamas's members in the West Bank when the three teens disappeared. So it is a very complicated issue, there's no doubt about it. And I think the question is whether the complexity is actually ever explained to the American people or people in general, and whether it's well represented. I actually think Israel's position is pretty well represented in media coverage. I don't think the other side gets represented very well, and it is an extremely complex issue.
Stas, are you still with us?
I am, and I want to thank you for allowing me to express myself, and I don't want to dominate the phone lines. I will say this in parting with all of you, and I wish you respectfully a wonderful weekend. I think that the main victims of the Hamas activity are the Palestinian people that they presume to represent. I think it's a corrupt leadership, and it needs to move on and allow someone more moderate and open to negotiation to lead the Gazans.
Well, thank you.
Live in dignity.
Well, thank you. And we brought these guests on specifically to provide context. And Summer, why don't you jump in here and respond to some of Stas's comments?
Sure. Well, I'm sorry that Stas jumped off the line, but I want to thank you for giving him airtime and allowing the three of us to be able to respond, because that isn't, after all, the point of our show today. I think we need to begin with the facts. And the facts of the case right now are the ones that Larry mentioned at the outset of the call. And that is that prior to this latest war initiated by Benjamin Netanyahu, Hamas had not fired a single rocket in the past year and a half. We need to consider the fact that Netanyahu, a full 6 weeks before the three yeshiva students were kidnapped, to say nothing of their murder, which now apparently seems to have happened on the very same day, had announced his intention very clearly to wreck the Palestinian reconciliation agreement and finish what he has tried to do numerous times with Hamas, most recently in November of 2012, which is to say destroy them. And in no case, neither he nor Ehud Olmert before him, who waged war on Gaza in December 2008 and January 2009, have been able to do that. What they have been able to accomplish is to kill hundreds and hundreds of Palestinian civilians, each of whom is frankly disagrees with what your caller just said, which is that somehow the government of an occupier is better than the good government or the good sort of authority of an occupier is better than the bad government of their own, to paraphrase Gandhi badly. In the end, Palestinians want to be represented by their own people. They want self-determination. And I have to tell you, as someone who is more concerned with, again, the facts on the ground and what people are actually saying, what I'm hearing from people who are otherwise, you know, quite liberal, quite secularist, and frankly have nothing in common with Hamas and its Islamist views, is that they're no longer referring to Hamas as, you know, a rogue organization, but rather as the resistance. And we have to ask ourselves, those of us on the call, as we sit and we watch, you know, entire families getting bombed, four children getting bombed on the beach, three children before that or the day after that on a rooftop. Do the Palestinian people have a right to resist that? Or are they meant to be waiting on the international community to jump in and stop the slaughter? The waiting has resulted in nothing more than President Obama announcing just today that he continues to defend Israel's right to do what it's doing. The U.S. Congress, which of course is the largest military funder of the Israeli military, passing a resolution saying that it's okay. Palestinians literally have no recourse. And so...
And Summer, on that note, I hate to cut you off, but we just got a line into Gaza. And so I'd like to welcome Sharif Abdul-Quddus to the show. Sharif is an independent journalist and correspondent with Democracy Now! Joining us from Gaza. Hi, Sharif. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So where are you right now in Gaza? It's about 8:45 in the evening there.
I'm in Gaza City right now at my hotel, just working on an article.
And so can you give us the latest? I mean, what has happened today with the ground invasion?
Well, Israeli troops moved into Gaza last night. I mean, I think we have to be clear on when we say ground invasion. They haven't really moved into Gaza. They crossed the border, but by some accounts of residents who were fleeing northern Gaza, they just moved in a few hundred meters, but then began to very intensely shell areas of Gaza, especially the north and eastern parts near the borders. This has been a very intense assault for the last 2 days, well, in fact, the last 11, but the last two have been particularly brutal, attacking from the land, air, and sea, with naval ships firing, tanks firing, Apache helicopters. There's an incessant buzz of drones overhead that I can hear now. There's the screech of F-16s flying overhead and raining missiles down. And this has been life in Gaza for the past 11 days. There's been... I spoke to one resident today in eastern Gaza. You know, Israel lauds these calls and warnings that it gives to residents before bombing. But for the people of Gaza, it really is a reminder of the powerlessness that they have against this Israeli military machine that is destroying their lives. One man got a call on his cell phone today at 7:30 in the morning, and the man identified himself in the line as an Israeli officer. He told the man, he referred to him by his first name, he said, "Gamal, you have 5 minutes to leave your house." He told the officer, "I have 15 children in this house, we're five families, I'm not wanted, I'm a civilian. Don't bomb us." He said, "You have 5 minutes to leave. You're scheduled to be attacked." And he rushed his family out of the door. And a few minutes later, they watched as their house was reduced to rubble. This is the life that people have in Gaza right now. And I also went and visited the patients of El Wefa Hospital, which is a rehabilitation clinic that came under attack last night. They've been getting calls from the Israeli military telling them they have to evacuate. They have refused to do so. They have severely disabled patients in the hospital, some of whom are comatose, many are paraplegics, who cannot be moved. But after iftar yesterday, shelling began. They hit the fourth, third, and second floors of the hospital. The patients had all been moved before to the first floor, and the doctors and staff had to carry the patients, some on stretchers, some in their arms, out One of them I spoke with, a 16-year-old girl who has a cancer in her spinal cord and is paraplegic, described how the electricity went out, dust filled the air, they couldn't breathe, and she said she was terrified. And they've been transferred to a clinic in Gaza City. So it's these kinds of stories that we continue to hear. They've attacked also a hospital in Beit Hanun earlier today, where up to 400 children are taking shelter, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry. They this morning attacked a media office where 30 journalists of a TV production company have been spending the night there working for the past 11 days to cover this assault. It's a very well-known office. And without warning, an Apache helicopter did a triple strike on the 8th floor. Miraculously, no one died. Only one person was hurt, but the office was largely destroyed. You know, it's these kinds of stories that that really bring to question what is Israel doing when it says it's targeting militants and trying to destroy Hamas. Why is it attacking hospitals and media facilities?
Sharif, I read about the Al Wafa Hospital. Where are people who are hurt and injured going if these hospitals are being bombed?
Well, the main hospital in Gaza City is the Shifa Hospital. It's you know, it's packed with patients there. Whenever you go there, you see young children hit by shrapnel. You see amputees. They're taken there. But yeah, I mean, the number of medical facilities is dwindling as they keep attacking them. So it's sparking a humanitarian crisis. Israel has destroyed over 1,600 homes. Yeah, that's a figure provided by the United Nations, not by the Palestinian officials. And it's, you know, there's been 22,000 people displaced. They're crammed into UN-run schools. They live in classrooms, 10 to 20 people as a family sleeping on the floor. They don't have much food or water provided to them. It's very hot, and they're crammed into these small classrooms. And you know, this with this ground invasion, if it does escalate and the troops move in, then the violence will only get worse.
Sharif, after the four boys were killed on the beach, a number of journalists were nearby in the hotels, and so they wrote first-person accounts about this. So are there a lot of international journalists in Gaza, and what is the update? I mean, how are you able to move around? I understand that the IDF has told journalists to leave the area. Can you give us an update on that?
There are a fair number of international journalists here. They're distributed in, you know, a number of hotels. You know, people move around. They wear flak jackets and helmets. It's very hard and very dangerous to move around at night. That's when the bombing is always most intense, the bombardment. I don't know if you heard that, but a huge boom just rang out, some kind of strike. But no, you know, journalists, of course, are risking their lives here because the attacks are can come at any time and anywhere. You know, if a house is destroyed and you go to it, sometimes they hit it again. So you have to be very careful.
I just want to ask our journalists if they have any questions for you, Sharif. Mark, do you have any questions for Sharif?
Well, actually, I'm fascinated with what he has to say about the Al Wafa Hospital, because we did a piece last week about an American who was among the foreigners who had gathered at the hospital in an effort to prevent.
I'm sorry, could you repeat? I can't hear very well. If you could repeat.
Yeah, so Mark said that his reporter did a piece about the Al Wafa Hospital, and a number of international activists are standing in solidarity with the hospital to try to prevent attacks. But go ahead, Mark, and then I'll let Sharif know what you're saying.
Well, my question was, what happened to those people?
So, Sharif, what happened to the international activists who were standing in solidarity at the hospital, at the Al Wafa Hospital?
The hospital was first shelled, the fourth floor was first shelled on a Tuesday, and the activists had gone there in solidarity. They were staying two at a time and taking shifts to always be there. They were from different European countries. The night of the attack yesterday, there was two Spanish nationals, a man and a woman, who were there. They helped evacuate the patients, but they were unharmed, and everyone has left the area. The Al Wafa Hospital has been destroyed. This is a facility that was built in 1996. It's very well known in Gaza as a rehabilitation clinic. It's very well known to the Israeli military. and everyone is continuing to question, and Israel has not provided an answer as to why they insisted on destroying it.
Hmm. Samer, you wrote about this hospital. Do you want to jump in? Do you have a question for Sharif before we let him go?
Can I ask a question?
Yes, Larry, I'll get to you in just a minute. Samer, do you want to go first?
I can't remember where I read it, but I've been
Sharif,
read it somewhere.
Samer, go ahead.
Just very briefly, Sharif, I wanted to ask you, it seems that in the last 48 hours, the Israelis have really taken to shelling along the border, and my understanding is that Al-Wafat was about 500 meters from the northeastern border of Gaza. Can you talk to us a little bit about what's going on with the shelling right now, and maybe describe a little bit, what it means in terms of indiscriminate targeting of those areas?
Well, certainly the heaviest attacks are in those areas. One of the doctors at the hospital at Al-Wafa said it was more about a kilometer away from the border. It is on the eastern end. They're shelling in the north and in the east and driving thousands of people into the city center. With respect to whether they have specific targeting, I mean, they've hit so many civilian sites, they've hit so many homes. They've killed 77% of the deaths to the United Nations figures, are civilian. They've killed over 50 children. Either Israel is able to do precision targeting, and if that is the case, then they are targeting civilians. Or they can't do precision targeting, and they're raining bombs and shells and artillery down on a very densely populated area. They can't be both. So, it has to explain itself.
And Larry, you have a question?
Yeah. Sharif, I may have read it in Haaretz, but I'm not sure. I know I read it somewhere, that the army did not target Al-Wafa Hospital. They targeted a building nearby where rockets were being shot, and the holes in the walls and the damage to Al-Wafa came from the attack on the building nearby. Do you know anything about this? Do you know that there was a direct targeted attack on the hospital?
According to the executive director of the hospital, they've been receiving calls for days telling them to evacuate and that the hospital was going to be bombed. According to two people, executive director and another doctor, they got a call right after iftar, so about 8:30 p.m. last night, saying they'd need to evacuate and it was going to be shelled. And they proceeded to hit the fourth, third, and second floors. So, either they're telling them to evacuate because they're hitting the building next to it, but they very intensely bombarded Al-Wafa itself. So, again, either they're missing and they're killing civilians and destroying medical facilities, or they're intentionally doing this. But either way, it's a crime.
All right. Well, Sharif, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. That is Sharif Abdul-Qaddous, an independent journalist and a correspondent for Democracy Now, joining us from Gaza.
Can I say one thing here?
Larry, yes.
Okay. I spoke to Human Rights Watch's main guy in Israel and Palestine, and I asked him about this. And he couldn't guarantee, what's going on, what's not going on at Al-Wafa Hospital. But he gave another example. There's a hospital or a big clinic in, I think, Jabalia refugee camp that was hit, and several people were injured. And he said, evidently, it was not directly targeted, because if it had been, then you wouldn't have had injuries, you would have had deaths. Okay? He said that, Israel should be taking a lot more care about where it drops bombs, because these bombs are so powerful and Gaza is so compact and so crowded. And if somebody's firing rockets two houses away from a hospital, maybe you should give up on that target because of the danger of hitting the hospital. That's definitely a legitimate argument. I asked him. I also asked somebody from B'Tselem, the human rights organization. Is there any evidence of Israel deliberately targeting hospitals or health clinics that are not being used as anything except hospital and health clinics? And they said they can't. No, Israel is not. They have no evidence of that. I personally find it hard to believe that Israel is deliberately targeting hospitals that are being used strictly as hospitals.
How do you get?
I'm more apt to believe, like I read, I'm not sure where, that the hospital in, that Al Wafa was hit as like a ricochet from an attack on something else. It's hard for me to believe that Israel is directly attacking hospitals that are being used as nothing as but hospitals.
Samer, did you want to jump in here? You did wrote a piece about this hospital.
I did, yeah. And what I did, I've spoken numerous times also to Bill at Human Rights Watch, and I think what's more important here is that that we get the opinion of people who are, you know, sort of artillery infantrymen, people who are military people, and understand that when you fire shells from a tank or from a naval warship off the coast of Gaza, which the Israelis are also doing, you are taking a chance there that you don't take with an F-16 or a drone or an Apache helicopter. These are deliberate choices that the Israeli commanders are making. And when you compare it with what was done in November 2012, for example, Netanyahu at the time had announced his intention to destroy tunnels along the Rafah border between Gaza and Egypt, and he did so with F-16s. And it's important to remember that those tunnels were far more sophisticated, far more deeply entrenched and dug than the ones that the Israelis are claiming Hamas is digging right now. So the question is, why use tanks in the first place? Why use heavy artillery against the civilian population when you know full well that that is less precise than you know, an airplane or a drone?
That's a real good argument, and I totally agree.
And Larry, we only have about 20 seconds.
But I totally agree with what Samer just said. But again, that's a different argument and a different criticism than saying that Israel is deliberately targeting hospitals that are being used for nothing but hospitals.
Well, we will definitely continue to follow this, and be sure to check yourcallradio.org for links. That's Larry Defner. He writes for 972 Magazine. He's a former columnist with the Jerusalem Post. Samer Badawi is a contributor to 972, former correspondent with Middle East International, and Mark Seibel is chief of correspondence and foreign editor with McClatchy. Thank you all for joining us, and thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What's the importance of protecting animals in urban areas? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Ty Moses, author of Zooburbia, Meditations on the Wild Animals Among Us. More than 80% of us live in cities or suburbs, so many of us are cut off from nature in our daily lives. But Moses says it doesn't have to be that way. Urban animals are all around us. So how do you connect with wildlife in your backyard? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan, Ali Budner, and Becca Hoekstra produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
So, you think you know it all.
Are we going to be the first pair to lose the quiz in forever?
Possibly. How many is it now?
That's zero right and two wrong.
How many wrong can they get?
Sarah.
I think they can only get two more wrong. No, I don't know.
One more wrong.
I don't know.
Quiz?
Okay, you're fine.
There's no.
All right, what's
left?
Going?
Join me this week for fun laughs and the quiz on What Do You Know from PRI Public Radio International.
What Do You Know tomorrow at noon here on Local Public Radio. It follows West Coast Live with Sej Thompson that begins at 10 o'clock. Tomorrow, Sej will be coming to us live from the Ferry Building with Chris Collin and Rob Baedeker, who offer useful and hilarious insights in what to talk about on a plane, at a cocktail party, and in a tiny elevator with your boss's boss. Mike Greensill and the West Coast Live Orchestra as well, tomorrow at 10. Here on KALW San Francisco, we continue now with the BBC's World Have Your Say.
Hello, welcome to World Have Your Say. I'm Anu Anand. Today, global grief and resolve over the downed plane.
An Asian airliner was destroyed in European skies, filled with citizens from many countries. So there has to be a credible international investigation into what happened.
President Obama has called the shooting down of Malaysian Airlines MH17 an outrage of unspeakable proportions. At the UN, diplomats have said Russia must answer for its actions in eastern Ukraine. We'll hear from Malaysia, the Netherlands, Russia, Ukraine, from the friends of those who died and from experts on what happened. And we'll share tributes to the passengers, including 100 AIDS researchers. You'll find us on Facebook.com/World Have Your Say. Thank you.